Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This week, I'm in conversation with Dagmawit Wubschet, whose book, The Calendar of Loss, has had a really transformative impact on how I engage with the work of our elders and ancestors from the 1980s and 1990s. In our conversation, Dagmawit's talking about the future and how those of us who can never be sure that we have a future have a necessity to live fully in the now. We have a responsibility to do that. And so that made me think of my 2018 conversation with Mark Thompson, who's a longtime activist and advocate for Black gay men in the UK. He's one of the original founders of Prepster, and he has a long history of community organizing and engagement. He co-founded, for example, Big Up in the late 1990s to respond to the sexual health needs of Black queer men. Here's a clip from our 2018 conversation, which took place in Mark's home in Brixton.
Do you want to elucidate for me what your experience was in the 80s? And I think,
just bit of it? It was a big decade.
It was a big decade. Well, I think I'd like to focus on the HIV crisis. Mm-hmm. And from there, we can go anywhere there.
Yeah.
But I really want to understand and want other people to understand that environment.
What was going on?
Yeah, what was going on? Because I know I've read what I've read from that time, and so I understand kind of what was going on in mass media, which, from what I've gathered, was really focused on white people. As far as HIV/AIDS,
from
what I've gathered.
Yeah,
and so kind of I'd like to understand more what your experience was as a gay Black man when the AIDS crisis descended on London.
Okay, I mean, I think that. It was presented as, it's an interesting one, because it wasn't even presented as a white gay or white person thing, it was presented as a gay thing,
right.
And then gay,
okay.
Red, white.
Okay.
Pretty much
got
what it.
It
does now. So, and even when I do reflective documentaries and stuff with people now, and there's still folk who like, hey, let's make a documentary about the 80s, I'm always having to say to them, you know there were Black folk, right? And so they're like, could you get me some? And I'm like, here I am. So it's usually me. And off you go, you had to wait 2 weeks. And I came back and I got a positive result and blew my mind. It's like 4 weeks before Christmas.
So you got a positive result in 1986.
Just November.
November 1986, when you were 17.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was 6 months old when you received your positive result.
I mean, I love doing workshops with younger gay men and, you know, and saying, you know, so how long have you been diagnosed and how old are you? And then drop in, I have a virus older than you. And I always think that's highly amusing. to try and tell me shit.
Okay. So pipe down, little one.
Yeah, really. Okay.
I've got a virus older than you.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you got ID to prove
that's
it?
That's going to be the name of this episode. I've got a virus older than you.
Yeah, trust me. and I know that I was in the community.
Sorry, that's really funny.
I
have to laugh at this.
No,
shit,
absolutely.
Right?
I mean, shit. I mean, God, 30 years. I've got, you know, I have to laugh at it.
You've had HIV for 30 years.
32 years.
32 years.
Mm. I've been diagnosed 32 years. Yeah.
Oh, because of course you might have had it.
I might have had it before that.
Right,
not much longer before that. I'm pretty sure how, when, where, and who.
Really?
Yeah. Because now I understand seroconversion illness, so I know all the signs, and I can track back. So it kind of all makes sense, you know. But I do remember at the time, not many people in the Black gay community, because it was a Black gay community. It wasn't a Black queer community.
Right. Okay.
It wasn't, you know. From all over the diaspora, it was African, Caribbean, and African, usually second generation, third generation men who were black, British, very different experience and very, very smaller. And I remember nobody, I didn't know anybody. There was nobody to talk to about it. And I told one or two people.
So, okay. Yeah, so you got your diagnosis in November and you had no one to talk to about it.
I told my mom.
What was your mom's reaction?
My mom's reaction was the best reaction in the world. She just said to me, you might get knocked over by a bus tomorrow. At least I know what to do to support you and help you.
Wow.
That was it. Don't worry, you'll be fine. Of course, I know she probably broke down in pieces after.
But of course, behind closed doors, yeah.
Yeah, but she did what she needed to do. And even now, my mum is like, anyway, you know, on my case. But she, yeah, she was completely supportive.
Wow. Mm. Okay, so then we can move on. So you then had, you told a few people besides your mum.
Mm-hmm.
And your point is that there was not, I mean, there wouldn't have been any support services
for there was not for who?
For gay black men.
No. There were one or two support services opening up, you know, the Landmark, the Lighthouse, which were usually to help people die and to get through the day to day because people were dying. I mean, this is the thing. And if you're 17, 18 and you've got this hanging over your head and you're young and you're pretty and you're at college doing your A-levels and you're about to go off to uni because you're smart, and then all of a sudden you're like, fuck, what am I going to do? That's resilience. And
there it is, defined.
Bam. So there were no... But I did find support services when I needed them. And I needed them for emotional support. I was very fortunate. I never got unwell. I was never hospitalised. The only time I got well was when I started HIV treatment, funny enough. Like 17, 18 years later. But I never got ill, so I was really lucky. But I did go to support services because I needed a sense of belonging and camaraderie. And I knew in the black gay community, the handful of people I told other people and told other people. So before you knew it, I was marked with the virus.
Right, and so did you feel like you didn't have any choice but to own it?
No.
Or did you have a time where you were like, you didn't want anyone to know?
Completely. I mean, I tried to keep it really close to my chest, and I would date people, and I wouldn't disclose, so I'm sure you're probably listening. And I would sit by the phone in dread when that phone would ring, and I'd get, listen, we need to talk. And that happened a few times.
Wow.
Yeah. I spent a lot of my early 20s angry, scared. I hated the black gay scene, hated the black gay community with a passion because they gossiped about me. They took my name and made it mud when they should have, at the time, should be supportive. There were men. I mean, that happened a few times where guys would call me. I'd see somebody and they'd be like, you know, and I'd be like, who told you? And then this person told them because they would look out for them.
Right.
That's kind of bullshit. So now I also...
But I mean, people don't know.
I get that now. I mean, I completely... Right. I understand that now. But flash forward 30 years, I still get young queer men who have been diagnosed frightened about talking about their HIV
right.
Also have had their status, you know, disclosed on their behalf.
Mm-hmm.
By other people, and I just saw something on social media a couple of days ago. You know, I know these horror stories exist still 30 years later. So I found support. I went to groups and drop-in centres because they were, you know, places to hang out. You know, the staff were always lovely. You know, you could go there and you could be positive and it was safe. Get a little massage, you know, and hang out. But my issue, it wasn't an issue. But I was young. So I was a lot younger than a lot of the people that were there. I was black, you know, and I wasn't ill and I wasn't dying. So when you enter that space, you're like, oh, you're a new volunteer. And I'm like, no, actually, I'm one of you. Just waiting. I might be in that chair one day. Went for a lot of therapy to kind of get myself sorted. But the outside world in the 80s around HIV and the early 90s was scary. It was a really, really frightening time because it was this spectre that was just hanging over us.
Mm.
And I knew one or two men who were positive. And then occasionally you'd hear that somebody had died, you know, but it was all mysterious. And I'm never going to say scores and scores of my friends died. That didn't happen to me, right? I knew people that died. I didn't know loads. I didn't lose lovers.
Right. So it wasn't like this kind of what we're used to seeing. I mean, if you've seen A Normal Heart.
Oh yeah, 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 oh, yeah. I mean, I know all the age.
I cried my eyes out. Mm. But it's, and this is, I think it's true on some levels in Angels in America and what have you. These are all very white narratives.
Yeah.
And it's, everyone loses everyone.
Yeah.
So.
I think our story around the epidemic is yet to be told.
Wow.
If you look at, if you, you know.
What do you think is yet to be told about the epidemic that differentiates it from the mainly white narrative that we see?
Just a simple, I mean, for me, it's a, if we look at it from a UK perspective, the simple story of
right us, UK AIDS epidemic,
of us living through it, right? The fact that there were one, two, three, at least three or four organisations set up in the 1980s. The fact that one of the first men diagnosed in this country was a black gay man.
Really?
Yes. I will get more information for you
because I'm going to put that in the show notes.
His name is Alan Warren. He died a few years ago of cancer. And
wow, say his name again.
Alan Warrond.
Alan?
Warrond. That might be the wrong pronunciation, but I'll definitely check for
you. Okay.
And Alan, along with Jonathan Blake, were a couple of the first men diagnosed in this country. And Alan was my elder, to be fair. And I had a lot of time family because he was this older, positive man who was stunning. I mean, I think he was a dressmaker, and he went on to set up Blackliners, which was a HIV charity for black African and Caribbean people. I'll send you a picture of that. I've got it in the archive somewhere. He set up and was involved in Riverhouse, which still runs to this day in West London because he lived in Hammersmith, so he wanted local services. And so there were men like that that I knew on the periphery of life. And then in the kind of late 80s, I got involved in Blackliners because I knew I was well. And so I wanted to do something. And I got involved with that for a little while and then went on from there.
Did you ever struggle with that wellness?
Yeah. I had a little moment of survivor's guilt in 94-ish, 95, which probably kind of like about 10th year of my diagnosis, of wondering why I hadn't got ill. You know, what was it? What was I? And it wasn't like doing right or wrong. It just weighed on me.
Why you?
Why me? And when you think, why me, you think, when am I going to be next? You know what I mean? It must be just around the corner.
So you were well, but I can imagine at that time that everything must have felt so urgent.
Yeah.
As in, I have to live today.
Yeah. I mean, I dropped out of college. You know, I was on a path to go and you know, study film and do a whole range of different things. You know, I was that kid in my family. And it was, you got to live now, you know, you just enjoy life. But it wasn't throwaway. I think I got more throwaway in my 30s.
Right, when you were like, I'm totally fine.
Yeah, it was a little bit of that. Like, fuck it, I'm going to be here, the meds work, yay! You know, and yeah, there was much more risk-taking. There right. was much more putting myself on the edge. I think I was a little bit more cautious about taking risks with myself, but there was a sense of live now, but there was also a limitation put on myself. So I didn't invest, I didn't go to uni, I didn't study, I worked.
Right.
You know, I didn't save. Why would I?
Why would, yeah.
So that leaves you in a slightly different position when you're in your mid-40s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there were opportunities that were afforded to me at the time that I didn't take because it would have meant disclosure.
So there were things that you didn't do because you would have had to disclose that you were HIV positive.
Yeah. I couldn't travel to the States. I was...
Sorry. You what?
I couldn't travel to the States. There was a travel ban.
Really?
Obama lifted it. There was a travel ban for donkey's years in the US.
I had no idea. They don't talk about that often, do they?
Well, we used to a lot, but it's been lifted. I mean, there are a number of countries you still can't travel to if you're positive, up to this day, usually in the Middle East. But up to the US...
Is this even positive and undetectable?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. You could. Yeah, there are some countries, but the US, it must be 2008, 2009 it was lifted. But back in the 80s, I don't think the ban was on then, but it would have been meant a level of disclosure for me, so I didn't take up the chance.
Wow.
But you couldn't travel to the States if you're a positive person. That was a public health measure. I remember going to the States in...
That makes sense, because there was this patient zero was a flight attendant.
Patient zero.
Yeah, quote-unquote patient zero. Yeah. Yes, was this white flight attendant who I think was originally from Toronto. I might have gotten that incorrect. So that makes sense. You know, it's so funny that I learned these things about HIV and AIDS, and i.e. patient zero, and he was a flight attendant, and these esoteric descriptions of the time before me then kind of come crashing into place when I speak to someone who was there and says, I couldn't fly to the States. And I go, oh my God, of course, because a flight attendant. So that's the first thing you would do.
I mean, you were living in a time where, you know, people were getting evicted out of their homes. Shit was being pushed through their
doors. And that was happening here.
This is happening here. This happened in the UK. Physical violence. When I tell you that I would be frightened about somebody calling me up, I wasn't scared because, oh my gosh, this person's found out I'm HIV. No, I'm frightened of physical violence here.
Right.
I'm frightened of threats to my family, you know, because that I know it happened to other people.
You know, the irony of that, though, is that HIV is spread through blood, so you wouldn't physically assault someone.
Well,
at that time. Yeah. Right? It's kind of a tenuous irony, but you know what I mean? Is that this, it speaks to the misunderstanding of what it was, and like the attendant navigation that you had to do.
Yeah.
And like understanding this, you know, you're of a generation, you're the generation.
But then if you also got your community that isn't welcoming, accepting, and loving you as well, that's a lot of work to do. So I sometimes go to myself, why the fuck did I go and do things like Big Up and Blackliners and Let's Rap? And, you know, people of colour tent at Pride. Why did I do it? Why did I do it for my community? Because there was anger, you know? But it was also, going back to what I said, it's what I do.
And hopefully you see that now what you've done has had such an impact.
I hope so.
I mean, I hope just by virtue of me sitting in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I know that it has. I know that it does. And it's one of those things, you know, my mum is always fond of saying, you know, they're going to miss you when you're gone, right?
Right.
Which she usually says that to me about her.